This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. One Sunday morning in the spring of 1944, two basketball teams got together in a locked gym in Durham to play a secret game. It was an all-black team from North Carolina College for Negroes that played an all-white team from Duke University's medical school. The game took place a decade before the Supreme Court declared school segregation unconstitutional and years before Jackie Robinson desegregated Major League Baseball. And it remained a secret for years. But now the full history of the game has been documented in a new book. The Secret Game, a basketball story in black and white, sheds light on an important turning point in the history of basketball. And author Scott Ellsworth joins me in the studio today. Scott, welcome. Good to talk with you.
Oh, good to be here, Frank.
This is a great story, but actually the story about how you came to write the book is also fascinating. Tell us that one.
Well, it was really by luck. I was writing a different book on basketball. I was writing a book about the 1957 Final Four, which some of your listeners will know featured the North Carolina Tar Heels, University of Kansas with Wilt Chamberlain, great University of San Francisco team in Michigan State. And I'd planned this whole book about race and basketball and television and all that, and I'd worked on it for a long time. And I went up to Springfield, Mass., not far from where James Naismith invented basketball in 1891. I did some research at the Basketball Hall of Fame. And that weekend, there was an induction ceremony, and I just wandered over. And I was approached by this elderly African-American man, a guy by the name of John McClendon. And the name sort of rang a bell, something about Kansas, something about coaching. We talked a little bit more, and he told me that he actually knew James Naismith, who had invented basketball. He had been his last student at the University of Kansas in the 1930s. And I thought, wow, this guy's got some stuff to tell. So I'd done a little writing for the New York Times. I called the sports editor. I said, I'd like to go. I was living in Durham at the time and wanted to go do a piece on McClendon. He said, sure. I flew up to Ohio, interviewed him. And at the end of the day, we're just sitting at his kitchen table, and he pulls out this list of racial firsts in basketball. McClendon is like the most important guy in basketball, incidentally, that nobody's ever heard of, but he's a major, major figure. He was essentially the first black coach in the pros, first assistant U.S. Olympic basketball coach, first coach to win a desegregated national tournament, the NAIA, in the 1950s, all this. And at the top of the list, it says 1944, North Carolina College for Negroes versus a military team from the Duke Medical School, first integrated college basketball team in the South. And he's rattling on about this and that. And I'm thinking, this guy can't type because 1944, there's just no way. And I finally say, excuse me, coach, this has got to be 1954, 1964. And he said, no. And it was at that point that my my book on the 1957 Final Four was torpedoed to fall ever beneath the waves and to begin what has almost been a two-decade process of putting this book together.
So tell us that story, because the fact that there was a medical college or that these med students were here and we were in the midst of World War II is an important part of the story.
Well, it's a part of the story. Everybody, I think it's important to remember that when the United States went to war after Pearl Harbor, everything in American society changed during the duration. That included college basketball. And so most college basketball teams didn't no longer played a regular schedule against, you know, Wake Forest or Clemson or whatever. Instead, they played lots of military teams. And these were Army teams, Marine Corps teams, Navy teams. And they were really, really good. These were the military used them to build morale on Army bases. So they had former college stars from all over the country. And the team at the medical school at Duke was absolutely loaded. You had an All-American from West Virginia, an All-Southern Conference center. You had a member of Duke's championship 1943, Blue Devils Southern Conference championship team. You had really great players, and they shellacked everyone they played. In fact, they played the Blue Devils varsity and creamed them. So this was a really, really good team of players.
Right, so that's them. And then you talked about the Negro College, which is now North Carolina Central.
Right.
Right? And they had a team. And how are they doing?
Well, they're doing amazingly. And they're doing amazingly because John McClendon is this genius. And he arrives in Durham in 1938. And the fast break is just beginning. But he has a super revved up fast break. College basketball teams in World War II would maybe score 50 points a game. His team is scoring 60, 70, 80. They beat St. Augs 119-26. In the 1943-44 college basketball season, the North Carolina College Eagles are the highest scoring college basketball team in the world. He's also got a full court pressure defense. Nobody had that. He's having his players run for miles and miles out in the country. And nobody, it's the modern game, and he's perfected it. But there's a problem. And the problem is that the black colleges are not allowed in those days to play in the NCAA tournament. They can't play in the NIT. They can't play at Madison Square Gardens. So unless you're amongst the few lucky hundred to ever see him play, you're not going to know what they had done.
And you talk about some of those, like the fast break and the full court press. There were some rule changes that he took advantage of quickly. He was the first to see how you could take advantage, or among the first.
Well, he was. There were some other predecessors. But what everyone forgets, and this will just sound crazy to our listeners now, but up until 1938, at the end of every made field goal in a basketball team, play would stop. Both teams would gather at the center of the court, and they would reenact the opening tip. It's called the center jump.
Yeah.
And so that's why you had scores that were 12-20 and things like that. But what McClendon did, he took some of Naismith's ideas. Naismith was this great, the creator of basketball, but he also had some very creative ways of looking at it. And what McClendon did is he says, I'm going to create a whole new super revved up kind of basketball. I'm going to have my players in tip-top shape, tip-top condition, and we're going to play ball like nobody had ever seen before. And they did. And they just blew everybody out of the court. And the referees would get exhausted as well.
So here you've got this great team, but again, nobody gets to see them. And then we can't, they're not competing against white teams. And along comes this in 1944, and a terrific team with the med school at Duke. So how do they get together?
Well, they get together because that's the other part of the book which took a long time to write. One was to tell the story of the game. Part was to tell this basketball story. But the other thing is what's forgotten is during World War II in the South, there was an undeclared war against segregation and Jim Crow that's fought by just regular, ordinary people, black as well as white, who are challenging segregation or saying, look, in the future, we have to have a better country, a better world. And what happens is there are people crossing the color line, and they're doing it in very dangerous ways. There was a German-Jewish refugee couple who had gotten out of Nazi Germany by the skin of their teeth, show up in Durham in September of 1939. They had seen no Jews allowed signs back in Berlin. They hated the colored zone, whites only, no colored law signs here. And so they started hosting interracial gatherings at their apartment of college professors from UNC and Duke, whites, with black professors from North Carolina College, until the local chapter, the Ku Klux Klan, found out and threatened to kill them. But there were people who were reaching across the color line, including a group of Christian students at Duke University and at North Carolina College. They're both allied with the YWCA. They start holding secret clandestine prayer meetings, integrated prayer meetings on Saturday nights and Sunday nights. And out of this grows this idea. They start talking about basketball. Well, we got a pretty good team. Oh, yeah, we got a pretty good team. And that's where the idea was born.
I love trash talking at the prayer meeting, don't
exactly.
you?
Exactly. North Carolina tradition.
So the actual genesis of now, this particular game now, who instigates this? Who do they talk to? And how does it come about?
Well, it comes out of that prayer meeting. And some of the North Carolina College players were part of this YMCA group. They heard about it. And they go to Coach McClendon. And again, who's this forward-thinking genius, but he's against the game at first because he knows it's too dangerous. Just one quick aside. The same year of the game, an African-American soldier got onto a bus in downtown Durham, refused to move to the rear of the bus saying, I'm fighting a war for democracy. Why do I have to do this? The bus gets to the end of the line. The soldier walks off. The white bus driver, and all bus drivers were armed in Durham in those days, gets off and murders the soldier right there in front of everybody. No questions, no provocations. There's a trial that's held, and the all-white jury deliberates for 15 minutes before exonerating the white bus driver. If you cross the color line, you take a big chance. McClendon knew it was a chance, but there was this funny National Negro College Basketball Championship game, one game held in New York City in Harlem. North Carolina College should have won, But according to McClendon and others, the game was fixed by gamblers. They lost. And so as a result of that, he decided to take the chance. He also wanted to see how his black players, black competition, black players could they measure up against white players? Were we as good as they were?
So describe that morning. What happens that Sunday morning?
Well, that morning, everybody is just beyond nervous. The white players sneak over. They show up at the gym. McClendon meets them at the door, unlocks the doors, locks it very quickly. There is a official referee there. There's a scorer as well, too. And I won't tell you everything that happens in the game, but the game begins very, very nervously. You know, a lot of these, you know, most of the black players are Southern. They've been taught all their lives, you never look a white person in the eye, you never touch one. Well, now you're guarding one. So what are you going to do? So this incredible team starts off very, very tentative. Then there's a hard foul that sends two players, a white player and a black player, to the floor. Kind of foul that on a playground might end up into a fight. Everybody's, you know, McClendon's figuring this is going to be a race riot. It's all over. But it sort of lets some of the air out. And players started to find their game.
All right, and again, you're talking about the sheer amount of danger. And where was the game played?
The game was played right here in Durham at the old gym at North Carolina Central University. Then it was the North Carolina College gym.
And what about the players on the medical school, the white team? How many of them were actually from the South?
Well, most of them were Southern, and that was one of the issues. And because the Southern guys, they didn't want to do this. This wasn't what we were taught. This isn't how you live your life. But there was a Duke player who was from Montana named Jack Burgess. He'd grown up on an Indian reservation in eastern Montana, had played ball with Indian kids. When he was an undergraduate at the University of Montana, he had a black teammate. And so when he arrives in Durham, he just absolutely despises segregation, decides he's going to launch his war against it. When he heard about the game, it was like, we got to do it. But it took him a while. Finally, he challenged the honor of the Southern players. You got to remember, the Civil War is still a big deal in the South at this point. And he asked them whether they were chicken or not. That got their hair up. But the other thing that was going on, this is the war. And all of these medical students had seen patients die at the Duke Hospital. They'd gone off to see the military wards at Camp Butner outside of town, and they knew that life was short and that maybe their time to take chances, and they decided to take this chance.
We're talking about The Secret Game today on The State of Things. It's a book by author Scott Ellsworth. He's talking about a secret game in 1944 between an all-white team and an all-black team, years before desegregation would actually legally come to an end in the South, and also years before professional sports would be desegregated nationally. Who won?
Well, the game was won by the North Carolina College team, and they found their game again. There were some epiphanies that happened along the way, and then remarkably, there was a second game unplanned that happened after that, which was the two teams end up playing a game of shirts and skins. They mixed their squads, so you sort of had a doubly integrated team. And then there were a lot of repercussions after the game, a lot of things. But one thing that happened is that the word got out that there was a new kind of basketball being played at North Carolina College. And so all that summer of 1944, carloads of white basketball players for the Tar Heels in UNC drove over from Chapel Hill to try to get pickup games with McClendon's black players, and they were blown away by what they saw. And they then, when the war ended, went back to Philadelphia and New York and Boston and start to take these ideas somewhere else.
You think this game, because this game really remained a secret. I mean, you said you discovered it just a few, you know, 10, 12 years ago, right?
It does remain a secret. But, you know, and I was just thinking about this, Frank, you know, North Carolinians, we are so proud of being first in flight, first in freedom with the regulators before the American Revolution. I think you can make an argument. Some people think I'm crazy, but why not first in civil rights? I mean, look at this event. This is in 1944. This is 20 years before Selma. You have blacks and whites in the South risking their futures, their careers, maybe even their lives to do these things. And I think this is a part of a hidden history that now is being revealed that we all can be proud of, and I think we can also build upon it.
But the fact that it was a secret, do you think it had any lasting impact on the, on that movement itself, on race relations?
Well, sure, because it got out as well, too. I mean, even though it was kept secret, people knew about it. They knew about it at the university. And it's, again, it's part of this generation during World War II, these forgotten heroes who really start to lay the groundwork that the civil rights movement is going to thrive on. I mean, this is all part of the past. History doesn't always just happen at once. It's not always famous people. It's also these unknown people who are the ones who really built our world.
As part of this book, you got to talk with Dean Smith before he passed away. Tell us about that.
Well, that was wonderful. I love Dean Smith so much, and I'm so honored to talk to him. He was a little stiff talking to me at first. He wanted to make sure I recorded this interview. I was asking him about changes in basketball. But, you know, he had come from a very pioneering family racially in Kansas. His father played the first black player in the Kansas High School State Basketball Tournament when his father was coaching at Emporia High in the 1930s. They had been racial progressives and pioneers. And when I started to talk to Dean about his family, and he didn't suffer fools. And once he knew that you did your homework, it was okay. But it was an honor to talk with him.
A lot of fun. Great book. So good to talk with you, Scott Ellsworth. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Frank.
Scott Ellsworth wrote the book Secret Game, A Basketball Story in Black and White. He's going to be reading from his book this Saturday at Hayti Heritage Center in Durham at 3. Also going to be at the Country Bookshop at Southern Pines next Wednesday. And you can find out more about the book and all about his visits at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Our intern is Jess Clark. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.